So welcome, everyone, and thank you for coming tonight. As was referred to earlier, it is so important for our mental health, our stability, our capacity to lead our lives in a way that is that has a characteristic of a flow to it, that has ease to it, that has happiness to it, and that has a kind of calmness and equanimity, means that for many of us, we need an alternative universe, for want of a better word, than our drama. If all we have is our drama, the drama of self and other, you know, the drama of liking and disliking, the drama of getting and losing, the drama of success and failure, and all the drama that the self creates for itself, if that's our only reference point, then in a certain way we're lost, because we are prisoners to the drama. We are servants to the drama. And all we can do is kind of, the best that we can do is kind of endlessly try to kind of maintain some kind of hold on it so it doesn't get too, you know, too out of whack. It doesn't get too intense. Doesn't sweep us away too much. But it's very difficult if we don't have any other anchor than this drama. Now, obviously, there's a lot that could be said about, you know, a spiritual life, a spiritual practice, Dharma practice. But just at its very basic, sort of what we we're doing today, to begin to develop a relationship with other aspects of who and what you are, such as you are a body, you are a body that breathes, you are eyes that see, you are noses that smell, you are ears that hear, etc., mouths that taste. As well as minds that think and feel and things like that. But to be able to have the capacity of not having 100% of your life involved in the drama, which is, again, self-created. It is a world of thought. Whose thoughts? My thoughts. So you can see there is a... there's already a problem. if our reference point, if our sole reference point is only my thoughts, my perceptions, my way of seeing things, my feelings, you know, there's that is so self-contained, we can say, it's contained within a self, that it's hard for us to get out of it, to get perspective on it. It's so difficult to hold up a mirror and to really see what's going on. So just at the level of this very everyday capacity to have an alternative universe that one can ground oneself in the awareness of body, ground oneself in the awareness of breath, ground oneself just in the act of seeing. If you notice, your eyes see. It sounds kind of simple. But our eyes just see. Our eyes don't comment on what it sees. Do you notice that? Our eyes just see. And it's quite wonderful, unless we are blind or have cataracts or some significant disease component to our eyes, there's nothing we have to do. Our eyes see. Same way with our ears have this capacity for hearing, smelling, tasting. As well as our minds not only have the capacity for thought and perception, but have the capacity for mindfulness, for awareness, for concentration. And through those processes, the mind has the capacity of developing calmness and equanimity and more spacious aspects of relating to phenomena. So... again, by cultivating a practice of mindfulness, by cultivating a practice of awareness, by learning how to concentrate the mind, all which we might call cultivation, mental cultivation. We're learning how to cultivate, you know, the same way, you know, the farmer or the gardener cultivates the earth, learns how to cultivate the earth so it knows, so he knows, she knows how to grow things and how to grow things that they want, how to have good soil, how to raise the plants, how to weed, what to prune. You know, that whole act of cultivation is really what we're doing with this kind of mental culture in the mindfulness, in the mental, in the meditative tradition. So again, I'm just saying that so we understand that, you know, the practice of mindfulness, the practice of concentration, the practice of meditation isn't some sort of mystical, esoteric kind of process. But I would say it is a fundamental necessity, especially in this day and age, if one wants to have a mind that one feels a sense of ease and spaciousness and openness and a natural kind of buoyancy and happiness, which are the qualities of our mind. But it's the qualities of mind that is not overwhelmed, not overburdened by thought, and then the thoughts developing a certain way that they solidify into these dramas. We all know what I'm talking about, and that these dramas don't then have a life of their own, which goes down the road of obsessiveness and ceaseless ruminations and, you know, all that. So you can see it's a progressive kind of illness that if we're not careful, all of a sudden we think is normal. It is the new norm. But it's really not normal. It's not healthy. So again, I'm just restating perhaps what's obvious, that these fundamental practices that we're doing here, learning here, practicing, and hopefully taking home and practicing in our daily life, I think are essential for us to have a good life, a happy life, a peaceful life, and to have a mind that has equanimity. It's balanced. And we can go through our days like that. And the capacity of developing, of practicing this kind of mental cultivation, and eventually over time reaping the harvest, or reaping the fruits, is readily available to anyone, because we all have the same mind, and we all have the same capacities to cultivate the mind in the same way. You know, if you have a plot of earth and it's got some earth on it and it gets some sun and rain and or have access to water, but we know on that plot of earth, if we cultivate it right, you know, anybody can grow flowers or vegetables to some degree. We all may not be master gardeners, but that's really not the aim of all of us. But just to be able to grow what we want to grow nourishing things, beautiful things, in our garden, the same way we want to be able to grow those in our life. And if we want to grow that in our life, it has to be grown primarily in the mind, because it is really through the mind that the actions of our speech, our words, the actions of our body are all informed. Things begin in the mind. So that's why in this tradition, meditation, mindfulness, concentration, insight, all these various types of mind practices are what's emphasized. Any questions about that? It is obvious. Rather than taking questions right from the beginning the way we often do, I wanted to share, to begin a new kind of teaching today, and then maybe having some questions or comments toward the end. This is a very well-known short series of eight verses for training the mind that are especially well-known in the Tibetan tradition. even though these teachings and practices come from India. And again, you know, Buddhism began in India. The Buddha lived in India and came out of that tradition. And Buddhism was very dominant in India for many centuries, and was brought, these teachings were brought to India by a great Indian master by the name of Atisha in around the 8th or 9th century. But these are called the eight verses, and I have three different translations. They're all more or less the same. The eight verses for training the mind, and here they're called eight verses for thought transformation. So I want to share these with you. We'll probably get through a few today. Again, the emphasis here is on training the mind. Right now, what you are listening to me with is your mind. So this mind that has this capacity for awareness, this capacity to enliven eyes with sight, ears with hearing, mouth with taste, etc., as well as having not only the capacity of being totally present and alive, very in consciousness to what it's experiencing, also has the capacity of also doing the same with what might be called our inner life of thoughts, feelings, and perceptions. It can move. It is not bound. Right? We go, oh, this is outside, and then inside I have these, you know, some other part of me. But we see this awareness does not have barriers between outside and inside. So this mind needs to be trained, because the untrained mind gets itself in lots of trouble. And has the capacity of rather than creating happiness and well-being for itself and others, has the capacity of making a mess of things, so to say. So we need to train. We need to retrain this mind, and these verses are about that. And you'll get a sense for what it is. So let me begin with the first verse. And in one translation, it says, with the thought of attaining enlightenment for the welfare of all beings who are more precious than wish-fulfilling jewels, I will constantly practice holding them dear. And another translation says, with the determination to accomplish the highest welfare for all sentient beings who surpass even a wish-granting jewel, I will learn to hold them supremely dear. And here it says, by thinking of all sentient beings as even better than the wish-granting gem for accomplishing the highest aim, may I always consider them precious. So, what is it? Where is our minds? And what is it occupied with? From morning till night, from week to week, from month to month, from year to year. Right? Where is it now? What are its aims and intentions? What are its interests, etc.? I could say more about that. This is what this is dealing with. And so the first verse starts off and says, in terms of this transforming of this mind, of the thoughts of the mind, of the intentions of the mind, it mentions first the thought of attaining enlightenment with the determination to accomplish the highest welfare for all beings. By thinking of sentient beings, I want to accomplish the highest aim for them. So right away we go, wow. That's not where I'm at. Right? I mean, my concern all day is accomplishing my aims for myself. Right? I mean, if I'm honest, that's what I'm all about. Right? My mind, the thoughts in my mind, are really just focused on myself and accomplishing my aims, or maybe the aims of my family. I may extend it out. But having right away the thought that I want to accomplish that my intention in life, my role in life, is to accomplish the highest welfare for all beings. I want to attain, with the thought of attaining enlightenment for the welfare of all beings, accomplishing the highest. So again, we can see that this first verse is really turning things very much around and giving us an idea that there is another very different mind state that can motivate us every day, all day. It doesn't mean, because if one has the intention of wanting to benefit all beings, well, who are all beings? Well, they're everybody I encounter. So it's not as if, you know, it's this abstract everyone. No, it means everyone, but each person is one of those everyones. So all of a sudden, I begin my day, I enter all my encounters in a totally 180. Because usually in all our encounters, we are coming from the place of self and seeing all these encounters in terms of myself. And how I'm perceived, or how I want to be perceived, or what I want from this person, or what I can get for this person, what this person is thinking of me, or what I need, or what I... You see, that's how usually how we approach all situations, as opposed to what is being suggested here, which is when I enter every situation with other people, my primary thought is, how can I be of benefit here? How can I be of help here? And more than that, it says that with the thought of attaining enlightenment for the welfare of beings, it even means my own, what we talked about earlier, you know, this self-cultivation, this wanting to be a better person, wanting to be a more peaceful person, harmonious person, calmer person. Why am I doing this? Well, not just for my own sake, but so I can be of more benefit to people, to my loved ones, to my family, to my friends, to my society, to my colleagues, that I have that capacity and I want to manifest it in all my actions. And then he says, and I'm doing this for everyone. All, he calls it, you know, it's a very common Buddhist term, all beings, all sentient beings. And here it says, who are more precious than wish-fulfilling jewel. So that's interesting. A wish-fulfilling jewel is obviously some kind of mythological jewel, right? It's sort of like, you know, all those magical things, you know, that you get all your wishes from, right? You know, it's like, what are those stories? Genie and the lamp and all that. You know, all those wonderful children's stories, you know, where there is this magical object that when you have it, anything you ask, you get, right? So here we would say, well, in the sense we're talking, well, what are the wishes, the deepest wishes of my heart? And we might say, my deepest wishes for my heart is that I can develop loving kindness, that I can be kinder, that I can be gentler, that I can be more compassionate, that I can be more patient, that I could be, enter into relationships more selfless and understanding and more capable of helping, right? So we might say, oh, these are, once we kind of take care of all the kind of daily life things that we got to take care of, if I really go deeper and say, you know, what really is the meaning of my life and purpose? For many of us, you know, we have these kinds of altruistic wishes for ourselves. And it says, well, who's going to grant me this wish that I can attain all these things? And here in the verse he says, well, living beings have that capacity, even more than the wish-granting jewel. They can give you everything that you wish. And again, many of us may go, what is he talking about? I find people incredibly annoying. They, you know what I mean? They drive me crazy. You know, I wish I had less to do with them, as well as, you know, they're always so problematic. You know what I mean? And they're stupid, and they don't know how to drive, and they, you know, have the wrong politics. And you know what I mean? It's like, for most of us, you know, we don't see all sentient beings as the basis of all of satisfying the deepest wishes of my heart, right? If anything, we see they get in the way of that. If I could only get rid of most of them, then my heart would be free and open. So he says, I want to accomplish the highest welfare for beings who surpass even a wish-granting jewel. And this is a very interesting, and again, another one of these 180s of this thought transformation tradition. Because what is being stated here is that if we want, if our wish, let's say, is to be a more patient person, a more accepting person, right? And a lot of people talk this way. They'd like to be that way. Well, we can only develop those capacities through our interactions with who? People, other people. See, there's no, you know, if you say, well, I really want to learn how to be more loving. Well, how else, you know, who teaches you how to love? But people. Who shows you about your incapacity to love? But other people. Right? Who shows you your impatience, your judgments, your non-acceptance, right? Who else shows you that? But only in your relationship with other people. So that is why in this turnaround you go, oh, you know, what is the, you know, what surpasses the wish-granting jewel to give me everything I want? It's human beings. And especially those human beings who are a stretch for me. So this is why in this tradition it is said that the person who gives me the most difficult time or my enemies are my best teachers. Because they are exposing, you know, if I'm willing to be exposed, my what? My shortcomings. All the places I need to work on. All the places that I'm not healed. All the places that I haven't transformed. All the places where I'm stuck. So, in this turnaround of thought transformation, we can see that in this first verse, for us to embrace this capacity to have, and when you say, when it's really an intention which then manifests in situations as thoughts. Because we all have thoughts, don't we? We all think about things, don't we? We all perceive things in a certain way, don't we? And the way we think about things, the way we perceive things, the way our inner dialogue with ourselves, the way we interpret things, conditions how we feel, how we act, how we interact, how we relate. Right? That is the filter. And so here, it's changing the filter. Maybe that's another way to put it. Right? Changing the filter. And it's a filter that you can see is incredibly open. Most of the filters that we carry as individuals are very narrow. They're very constricted. It's almost like, all experience is being twisted into this very narrow way we cultivate and manipulate our little world to make it turn out the way we want. But this is very open. Right? It says every experience, every encounter, every human being is an opportunity, is a wish-granting jewel that will give me the opportunity of developing and cultivating all these aspects of heart and mind that I yearn for, that I seek. But again, the underlying motivation has to be this desire to be of benefit to all beings and to heal and transform, that is, enlighten, awaken ourselves so we can be of benefit. And then if that's our intention as we set out every day on our journey in life, and everybody here has a different journey, right? We do different things, we go different places, we have different kinds of work, we have different kinds of involvements, we are involved with different kinds of people. All of that is different. But all of us can be united in this intention, right? In the way that we encounter all situations. And this really means that all situations are opportunities. All situations are opportunities for developing all the capacities of the heart and mind that we seek. Of course, what gets in the way of that? When we get lost in the drama of self. So this is a different way of looking at life, thinking about life, viewing life. Which is, again, we'll see more as we get into the verses, how, and to me, real spirituality has to be a 180, if it's meaningful. You know, if it's meaningful, we have to go, wow, I would have never thought of looking at life that way. No, I would have never thought to look at you know, the most difficult person in my life as a wish-granting jewel, right? That's not the way we usually think about things. Wow, I never thought, you know, that the most difficult person in my life is my best teacher. Oh, I need to bow to them. I need to be grateful to them, right? I mean, left to my own devices, I would think I'm some sort of wonderful, a highly developed being. And yet this person reveals to me how much work I need to do. Thank you. But can you see how liberating that is? You know what I mean? Because all of a sudden, because usually, again, we're stuck in the drama with these people and situations. And it's a painful drama because it's all about hurt and anger and resentment, right? And it just ruminates and festers. And who does it harm? Well, it harms ourselves. It harms ourselves, most essentially. Of course, it does leave the capacity of doing harm to others. But, you know, and this way of turning it around is all of a sudden so liberating. Question? Yeah, and actually, you will see Mimthakya in one of the verses. They'll definitely, but that is the essence. What you're talking about. I mean, what I'm talking so about. Yeah, there is an actual practice of within the tradition that in this tradition there's an actual meditative practice of actually exchanging self and other. But this is what we're doing here. Let me go to the next verse, which you'll see it even more clearly. So again, and just in the last word, I will learn to hold them supremely dear. And then it's, but another guy, he says, I will constantly practice holding them dear. I will learn to hold them supremely dear. So please, for those of you who are sitting here and thinking, wow, I'm not even close to that. Wow, you know. Interesting. I will learn to hold them supremely dear. Right? I will constantly practice holding them dear. It is a practice. It is a practice. This is why it's called mind training, right? Right. We have to retrain the mind by seeing things differently, thinking about things differently, acting differently, not doing any of that, creating pain and suffering for ourselves and others, remembering, correcting, right? Starting over again. So please understand, this is a practice. You know, this is why we often do, you know, metta practice, loving kindness practice. It's a practice. Because again, the mind, the self left to its own devices, only cherishes who? Itself. That's just the truth. This retraining of the mind is what's being done here. So please, again, this is why often these types of verses are often part of one's morning meditation. Now, actually, what I'm reading to you, I think for those of you who remember, is about a year ago I sent out about an 8-page sheet which had different of these different kind of verses and prayers from the Buddhist tradition. Again, they are good to recite often, so we remember. Right? So before we go out into the world every day, before we begin to take up, you know, all of us have roles and responsibilities with family members and relationships and work and all the, right, you know. So before we enter the world every day, how wonderful if we each had some time before the days begin to meditate, to quiet and calm and stabilize the mind, to generate these types of thoughts and intentions in our mind, so as we go into the day, every day, fresh, with this clear intention, right? And then, you know, life beats us up a little bit. Sometimes we do quite well, sometimes we don't do so well, but that's good because that's the learning process. And at the end of the day, we evaluate. How did I do today? Over here I did okay. This one still gets to me. I got to work on that one. Yeah, that one still gets to me. The next verse. Now this is interesting, and I know some people are going to have a quick reaction to it. Wherever I go, with whomever I go, may I see myself as less than all others. And from the depth of my heart, may I consider them supremely precious. Another translation says, whenever I associate with others, I will learn to think of myself as the lowest among them all, and respectively hold others to be supreme from the very depths of my heart. In the last translation, whenever I'm with others, I will practice seeing myself as the lowest of all, and from the very depths of my heart, I will recognize others as supreme, sort of like the others. So before we get into this, what is really, you know, the most important things being stated, he is again, and Thakur was just talking about the exchanging of self and other. He was again turning it around, right? Because in most situations, if we are honest, who do we see in most situations as most important and supreme? Right? That's the truth. And in most situations, we see everyone else as lower than, less than. I mean, that doesn't necessarily mean that we look down on everybody. In the sense, it means that my needs, my wants, that's what's most important here. Right? And everybody else's needs and wants are less than mine. Me first, right? Me first. I want to be first online. I want to get there first. Right? They can run out of food after I get served, but I want to make sure that I get the food. Right? Me first. If we're honest throughout the day, we see that even the littlest things, our primary concern is ourself. And what that means, of course, is that we are what? We are highest. We are supreme. Right? And many of us, if we were honest, would say, yeah, I wouldn't mind being supreme. Wouldn't that be wonderful? Right? If everyone in the world that I encountered, everybody was focused on meeting my needs. Right? I mean, if we're honest, that's really where we're at. And it's constantly frustrating to us that the world doesn't operate that way. And we have all these other people who, you know, they think their needs are important, as important as mine, or they think they come first ahead of me, which is really outrageous. So this second verse is now where we're kind of beginning to get into it. I say that I often get a reaction. A lot of people, especially, you know, since in our culture now we are very... We are very sensitive to issues of codependency and victims, you know what I mean? So a little bit goes, I don't like this. You know, a lot of people hear this and they think, but this is not really what's being said. That this is not like self-abnegation and you're going to let everybody walk all over you and like that. It really has to do with, again, how as we go through our life and situations, am I willing? I mean, I would say it's a step up for many of us just to enter into the world of equality, right? Can I see the other people in my life, their needs, their wants, their happiness, at least equal to mine? I should give at least as much heed, credence to theirs as my own. But of course, in this tradition, he is going further. He is saying, you know, can I be selfless? Can I be someone who, as I go through life, is really more focused on really satisfying others, making others happy, meeting their needs? And, you know, I don't mind being last online. Right? I don't mind if they run out. You know, well, you know, let the other people get the stuff. Let the other people be first. I don't care. Now, again, this is not a stance, okay? This is not an act. This is not being humble. That kind of action is really not in the Buddhist tradition. This is not external. This is really internal. And I would say to be this person, you have to be very healthy. You have to be incredibly mentally healthy. Because you know that so many of the things that people need or want really will not give them real happiness, will really not give them real satisfaction. You know what gives real happiness and satisfaction. So, in a certain sense, you're not giving up anything by letting somebody go first. By letting somebody win. Because hopefully we know that our own capacity for happiness and well-being is not predicated on getting all that stuff. We talked about equanimity. Equanimity means what? I am equal whether I win or lose. Most people what? If they win, they're what? In ecstasy. If they lose, they're devastated. Right? We see that. We see that in lots of arenas, not just in competitive arenas of sports, but in all kinds of arenas in life. But that winning and losing is such a relative thing and so changeable. Once you understand that, you can go, let them win. If that's going to make them happy and feel good, you know, I don't need to win to be happy. Let them win. But this even goes even further. Because I think when you are a healthy person and you really experience your interrelationship with everyone, you are actually happy when they're happy. You are actually happy when their needs are met, right? And I can prove that to you because if you think about somebody you love, right? If you think about somebody you love, somebody you care for, family, friend, when good things happen to them, when they win, how do you feel? You feel happy. You feel good. And you don't go, why not me? So we know in this very narrow way that how good it feels when people we care about and love and want to be happy succeed. And our first thought is not, well, how about me? Right? No, we're delighted for them, aren't we? Well, what would it be like if we felt that for everyone? Do you see how your capacity for happiness is increased exponentially? Yeah. And again, this may sound somewhat idealistic or airy-fairy, but it's really not. You know, if there's only one person's happiness that you care about, if there's only one person's success that you care about, then that, you have a lot riding on that one person. But let's say you have 50 people that you care about, that you want to be happy and succeed. Well, each of those people is only 2%. So it's really much more spread out. But also you reap the success and happiness of 50 people. And all of us have that capacity of training our minds to see things this way. It's a 180. But I mean, can you see that it's not that difficult? I mean, it may be difficult, but I'm sure everybody can right now understand it. Because again, to one degree or another, we already do it. We have people, hopefully, in our life, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 10, 15, 20, that we're very connected with, and that we want them to be happy. We don't want them to suffer. We want them to succeed. We want them to win. Right? Often, when we have somebody we love in our house, we what? We serve them first. Oh, you go first, right? Or if there's some kind of food or something, and there's some, like sometimes you're cutting cake or something, and sometimes, or a pie, and sometimes something gets a little smushed up or something, doesn't, right? Who do you want to have the nice-looking piece? The guest, right? And you say, oh, I'll take the one that's all messed up. I don't care. See, that's what it's like. Yeah, I don't mind being the lowest. I don't mind taking the ugly piece. You have the beautiful one. I want you to be happy. I want you to feel special. So hopefully when you do that for your guests, you're not secretly resenting them. Right? And the next time you go to their house, you're watching to see whether they do the same for you, And if they don't, really being resentful. You see, that's not it. So I say this is not something that comes from just somebody going, oh well, I'm gonna try to look a lot better in life by doing this stuff. Now this is really from the inside. You really live it. You want other people to be happy. So again, I'm willing to think of myself as the lowest and hold others supreme. Again, what this means is I am going to reverse the way I really do it, in which I am supreme and everybody else is beneath me. Supreme again meaning my needs, my wants, my desires, they're primo. They're number one. That's really what I'm about. Even when I'm acting nice, I'm really manipulating to get my way or to get people to think this about me or that. Can you see where that there's always self in that? But this is not that. This is going, you know, I let go of all that. I don't need anything. Other than what? Let other people be happy. And you know what? The other interesting thing is, if we live in a world, or let's say we live in a family, where everybody is happy, you know what? That's a nice family to live in. I'd much rather live in a family where everybody's happy than in a family where everybody's unhappy. So why not, if I'm in a family, contribute to that? Make that the emphasis. And again, it's not manipulative and it shouldn't be coming from any kind of, you know, I'm one down. It's just not about letting everybody walk all over me. You know what I'm saying? Please don't think it's like that at all. This comes from a very full heart, a very selfless heart, a very mature heart. This is a mature person. Any comments? I mean, does this seem beyond, you know, just way up there somewhere, way out there? Or does this seem like something everybody can bring into their life, their family, their relationships? Yes?
Is there a place in this for tough love, for letting people... Or at least not saving people from the consequences of their bad choices? Or... Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so everybody hear the question? This is, again, victimization and codependency, tough love and enabling are also things. And again, you're absolutely right. This is, again, tough love is love. Again, my own experience is that tough love for many people can become a technique. But tough love for me is love. Love means what? Love means you understand and you want to help. Right? So when your place is coming from love and you want to help another human being who is suffering, right? That's what matters. And so whether your actions appear soft and tender or whether your actions appear somewhat tough and assertive and firm, as long as it's coming from that same place, which is, I want to help this person. I don't want them to suffer. And I understand by being soft and mushy, right. So this is not saying, yes, I'm gonna help my... I'm going to make the needs of my, heroin addicted son supreme, and so therefore I am going to, give him anything he wants. No, this is not that. This is not that. And that's important, that we don't, that's what I'm saying. Sometimes we hear these kind of teachings and they seem like, again, this highest and lowest, it seems like, oh, so I'm just supposed to let everybody walk over me and everybody comes first and I'm just a doormat and... No, if you're thinking like that, it's far away from this. Okay, in the same way, no, sometimes, compassion means I want to stop somebody, I want to help somebody stop suffering. So doing something that facilitates their continuation of suffering is not very helpful, is it? Not very loving. So please understand, some people think that when they enter a spiritual path or something, they kind of give up, they have to give up their common sense. Right? This is not the case. Your spiritual life and your spiritual teachings and understandings should all have good common sense to them. That's very important. And again, you've heard me say before, that's what the Buddha said. He said, whatever I teach you, do not just take it because it's the Buddha who's saying that, because you respect me or love me or whatever. He says, don't do it. He said, take it through your own experience. Run it by your common sense. And only then practice. Good. Brian, you had a...
It says to look at beings as better than a wish fulfilling gem. And another reading we've done, it says to look when someone is giving you a hard time, to think about that like, oh, thank you for this opportunity to practice. One thing I wonder about, like say the pie example, So you go and you see the pie, and you see there's two pieces left. And then I've been trying to develop, where I say, oh, man, I lucked out here. I got an opportunity to practice. But is that...
I understand. So what's your... There are two pieces of pie.
One's mushed up, one's not. And I say, oh, man, I got an opportunity to practice. Here you go, Melissa. Here's a nice one. I get the bad one.
Okay.
But is that kind of... Can run the risk of feeding in even more to self, like, oh, it's not about... necessarily giving the piece of pie, it's about getting an opportunity to practice.
So that's good. And that's why, there's a famous expression in Buddhism which says, the raft is not the shore. I don't know if you've heard that. The raft is not the shore. I mean, there are many meanings of that. But at the level we're talking, it means, again, if one is on one shore, and one wants to get across the river to the other shore, one what? Needs a raft. One needs something to support one to get one over there. When you get to the other shore, you no longer need the raft, right? So you don't, when you get to the other shore, you don't, put the raft on your back and carry it with you on the other shore. At that point, it becomes what? A burden. You don't need it. You're at the other shore. But to get to the shore, you needed a raft. You needed some kind of support. So it could be, let's say, a guy like you, Brian, right? So you start as a complete narcissistic egomaniac, right? I know you well. You're right. And and all you think about yourself, right? I mean, in the old days, it would have been, two pieces there, one mushed up, one really nice. You would have just grabbed for that right away. All right. So now you're saying, I want to change. I can see the errors of my narcissistic, egoistic way. Right. So I'm going to be much more conscious. And even though I really want that other piece, and I really resent that Melissa doesn't offer it to me when I offer it to her, I'm still it's good for me to at least offer it to her and take the piece. Okay. So I would say, you're not at the other shore yet. All right. But at least you're on a raft that's moving in the direction of. Okay? And that's important. We can't think in absolute terms. Practice is a process of transformation. Transformation doesn't come just like that. Insights can come like that, but transformation comes over time. So I would say in the beginning, you understand that there's another way of dealing with situations like that, and you want to really begin this process of really, for a lot of us, just to notice that, just to go, oh, maybe this other person would like that nice piece. See, I mean, in our own selfishness, we don't even think of that. We always think about is, gee, I want that one. I want the one that looks good. We never think they might at least equally to myself like that kind of piece. And secondly, since you and Melissa are married and live together, she might have a 50% claim on that nicer piece. I mean, can you even grant her that since you live together, she's your wife, she may, like, some people aren't even aware of that. You see, so just, the raft is not the shore. But you're absolutely right. Over time, it would no longer come from here. It would just be a spontaneous thing. as we know that we do with people we love. You know, it's interesting. You know when you fly in a plane, and they give those instructions from the stewardess about the oxygen. You know, they say to parents, it just struck me, they say to parents what? What? No. And it just struck me, that's why they say that, because I think a parent, if something went down, the first thing they would do would be taking that and put it on their child, right? Because spontaneously, naturally, we think of our children first, right? That's love. So you have to be reminded, no, put it on yourself, that's not selfish, right? Because again, a parent, when the oneness is there, the need of the other arises, immediately in your consciousness. And if there's not a self-absorption, there's that response. And people do it all the time. I mean, it's not just the parents with children. I mean, ordinary people do heroic things. Right? They put themselves in harm's way for another. That's that same kind of, and it's usually not thought. It's natural, it's spontaneous. You see some suffering, and without even thinking, you go to be of help. You no longer have a raft to carry about. It's now you. But again, most of us need a raft. Probably many rafts. But over time, less rafts as it gets internalized. Any other questions about the practice? Yes. Oh, the question is, there are also practices and teachings which go beyond just phenomena, but really deal with the spacious space and spaciousness of awareness and mind. Within the Buddhist tradition, the meditative tradition, there is certainly at its deepest level, for those who have mastered two things. One, they have mastered their daily life enough that it is no longer a source of conflict and agitation, but that one's daily life is more or less flows and has clear sailing. When you have mastered your your mind is no longer continually agitated by the drama, right? And one has developed a certain degree of meditative stability and capacity to concentrate. It is possible. It is acceptable to begin to go deeper than thought, deeper than concept, and to use the power of the mind to really penetrate into the nature of mind itself. But practicing at that depth, right, is traditionally within the purview of a few, within the broader tradition. People who have the inclination, people who have the time to devote to, and people who have the aspiration. But certainly, when we talk about enlightenment, we're talking about that capacity that goes way beyond the drama and that really penetrates into the depths of the nature of mind, the nature of reality, which is just taking off from where we talked about. There's just a deepening sense of openness and spaciousness and ease. Any other questions? Because we need to end, and I want to make sure that this is understandable. And we'll continue with these verses. And there's six more to go. Yes, Steve.
This is a lot like Brian's question. question.
Uh-huh.
I think about how often I don't do anything near putting myself last or lowest, right? That I'm at some level putting myself first. But the times when I do feel like I start doing something like putting myself the lowest or the last, how often what I'm doing at some level is hoping somebody notices.
Yeah, yeah.
And then when I avoid that, right, then I'm not noticing just how much I'm tracking that I'm doing this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Steve,
that's okay. That's fine. You know, we begin where we begin. And just to notice that, I mean, I actually see it the other way. I see it that inclination to do good, that inclination toward altruism, is actually the natural movement of our heart mind. That is our awakened mind beginning to awaken, right? And that's, so your intention to act in a way that we may say in a situation is selfless, right, is coming from this awakening of your true mind. Now, at the same time, you have a very, right, habituated, highly activated sense of self that is usually what? Making everything about itself. And it wants to take credit for everything. So even when Steve begins to go off in a little different direction of being more selfless and altruistic, all of a sudden after about 2 minutes down the road, the self comes in and goes, look at me. You know? I mean, it just wants to take credit for everything. And it's very two-faced, because it's really just about itself. But it'll even take credit for selflessness, right? I mean, you know, my response to things like that is, I just smile. How silly. How silly of this little self. Right? Wants to take credit for everything. Cannot stop for a second. Right? You know, it's like a child, right? You know, you have children, and anyone, you know, hey, mommy, look at me. Look what I'm doing. Right? You know what I mean? That's a child. And again, Steve, I know you're more than a child. You're an adult, and you carry an adult life. But we realize we have these parts of us that are still like children. Right? You know, look at me, everybody looking, noticing how selfless I am. You know, what a good Buddhist I am. Smile. Just go, it's okay. I think you're special.
I love you just the way you are.
Yeah. All right, just like, you know, don't let that become a source of angst to you. That just, it's kind of humorous, actually. So good. It's just about 8:30. Are there any other questions about the practice of this? Please practice these early verses. And again, I know everybody here has computers. They're called 8 Verses on Training the Mind, and you can easily find them online. There are many different versions. And again, you can see the translations are more or less the same. I will continue over these next practice periods to go through these verses. They're really quite wonderful. And again, you know, you're not going to go home and be perfect. You'll probably go home and just realize how imperfect you are. But that's a beginning, right? I mean, in a certain way, that's a beginning. You know. So, you know, be gentle, be patient with yourself. So we'll stop here.